Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power and shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, in other words, to address real issues rather than defend positions. You know, we've all heard the saying that laughter is healing, and maybe you know the story about Norman Cousins, the writer, about 40 or 45 years ago. He was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness that was so serious, I can't even pronounce it. But instead of checking into a hospital, he went to a hotel room with Marx Brothers movies and Candid Camera reruns, and he got well. He wrote a book, Anatomy of an Illness, that caused quite a stir. As medical science began studying the healing power of humor, which is kind of like, well, it works in practice, but does it work in theory? Well, it turns out that laughter can heal, particularly when we recognize that the true meaning of the word healing is to restore wholeness. So in that way, the magic of levity can help us rise above the gravity in life and see from a higher perspective. So, in these most contentious of times, can laughing together keep us from crying separately? Our guest this week, Reverend Susan Sparks, is a trial attorney turned stand-up comic and Baptist minister. She has toured as part of an Abrahamic comedy troupe consisting of her, a rabbi, and a Muslim. Sounds like a joke. She thinks laughter is a universal language of the heart that can help heal the illusion of separation. Now, I first met Susan in the early 2000s at the Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor Conference in San Diego, where we were both presenters. And at that time, she was just making the shift from her career as an attorney to begin theological studies and apply her skills as a stand-up comic. Well, since that time, she's written three books, Miracle on 31st Street, Preaching Punchlines, and Laugh Your Way to Grace. She's made numerous appearances on TV, radio, and pulpits across the country. Currently, she is the senior pastor at the Madison Avenue Baptist Church in Manhattan. Oh, and she's also a Harley Davidson aficionado with a love for cowboy boots, which I suppose also makes her a Harley Krishna and a Buddhist. Well, anyway, welcome, Susan.
Thanks, Steve. I love that title, a Buddhist.
Yeah, my wife Trudy took on that. Yeah, you please steal it and use it. Exactly.
I will.
She's a Buddhist.
That's
okay.
Awesome.
Yeah, my wife Trudy, when we lived in Texas, she was a Buddhist and avoided many traffic tickets because of her her cowboy boots. Well, that's another story.
Well, I love the combo of cowboy boots and being a Buddhist. I want to totally tag team with Trudy sometime and chat with her.
You will. We'll hook you up. Anyway, let's start. I'm so curious. Tell us about your journey from the legal profession to becoming a stand-up comic and stand-up preacher. First of all, what sparked the change and how did you pick both comedy and ministry at the same time?
How long you got, Steve? Hey, how long do you say this program goes for? What, 4 hours? Is that good?
Yeah, just take up the first 3 hours. We'll stop when you need to stop.
I mean, in all seriousness, it is, you know, I'm trying to condense basically 40 years into a 5-minute answer, but, you know, I think it really boils down to kind of three core stories that in my life that all come down to a life lesson that uses the word do a lot. And the first one is around the idea of remember why you do what you do. And I think back to when I was, 5 or 6 years old, and I literally would get up, you know, on Saturday nights, I'd take all my stuffed animals and shove them in the corner and make up sermons for them, you know, before church. And that was who I was. That was just like organically what I did. So I was this goofy, funny little kid that loved storytelling and kind of to reframe it in terms of ministry and preaching. And unfortunately, I was raised in a very, very conservative tradition that did not ordain women. So I was told very early on that that was not going to be in the cards for me. So, you know, we don't, when you're six and somebody goes, well, we don't, people, you know, we don't ordain women, you kind of go, oh, okay. It's not like you've got the wherewithal to argue about it. So I immediately went, all right, then I'll think of something else. And the next thing you know, I end up being a trial lawyer, which sounds crazy, but it's really the same job, just different clients. You know, I mean, you're persuading people, you're being a counselor for people, you're communicating, you're engaging, you know, their kind of higher selves. Anyway, that's where I ended up being. So, you know, lesson number one, remember why you do what you do. So I go back to that wonderful moment when I knew that's what I wanted to do. Lesson number two, with the word do, is sort of bring all you are to what you do. And I have a vivid memory of practicing law early on. And I was the only woman in an 80-man firm. And I remember going to court with these little suits and perfectly matched blouses and blah, 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 matching verbs and nouns and the whole bit in front of a jury. But it wasn't translating. I could tell I wasn't connecting with people at all. I was more of a robot because I was scared, you know, and I was holding 90% of myself at the door when I walked in the courtroom. About 5:30 or 6, when I'd finish with court, I would throw all that junk in the back of my Jeep Wrangler, and I would go sing country music and do stand-up in these dark, smoky country bars in Atlanta. And one day, I remember I was at some place called, like, the Wagon Wheel, I think it was, behind Chicken Wire, you know, as one does. And I looked down in the break, and there was the managing partner of my law firm. And I just thought, oh my gosh, I just bought a house. I'm going to get bankrupt and I get fired. I looked at, he comes up and he starts laughing in the break and he goes, Susan, where's that woman on stage in the courtroom? She'd make a great trial lawyer. And you know, Steve, it was in that moment I realized that you have to bring all of who you are to what you do for stuff to really work. And I was checking all that creative, kind of funny side of myself at the door when I'd walk into court. So in that moment, I realized I've got to bring all of it. And part of that piece of me that was being excluded was the spiritual side. So then the whole thing started coming together, the stand-up piece, the kind of communicator, storyteller. And then I realized I've got to reclaim that call to ministry. So I went back to seminary. And the last story kind of goes to, I guess, the third lesson, which is go and do what you were meant to do. And I finished my first semester in seminary, and nobody thought bringing humor into a pulpit was a good idea. They all just, you know, the professors, the advisors, everybody just thought I was nuts. So in January, I just sort of panicked and I thought, I've made the worst mistake of my life. I've burned 10 years of law and I'm in seminary and I don't think I'll ever get a job with a reputable church. So I ended up driving across country in our break in January, ended up, and you'll appreciate this, in Texas, far west Texas, in the middle of a dust storm, pull off the interstate. Long story short, there's a boot shop at the end of the little exit. And I walk in, and the woman, just me and this, you know, young woman in there, dust storm all throughout. And I just tell her my whole story, and I just, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I've reached the dead end. I can't make money doing this, but this is what I'm called to do. She starts laughing, goes in the back room, comes out and says, this is what you need. You need yourself a pair of preaching boots. And I was like, what are preaching boots? And, you know, they were these gorgeous boots. She goes, well, I just sold these to a fancy radio preacher the other day. He said he needed something to put his feet into to stand tall and talk loud. And, you know, yeah, it was a sales pitch. But in that moment, I realized that it was all about, you know, the call was clear. My purpose was clear. It's just I had doubts because the world told me I couldn't. So, you know, there's my maybe more like 6 minute version of it. But the bottom line is, you know, you go through twists and turns in life. And I think early on, we're planted with the seed of our gifts and the world just tries to steal it away from you. But every once in a while, the universe will keep bringing you back reminders of where you need to be. And wow, am I blessed? Because here I am. I'm a professional comedian. I'm an ordained minister. And the two worlds have come, you know, crashing together with some really lovely results.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I'm always curious on this show, particularly because we do talk about politics and all that sort of stuff, but always curious as to how people find their calling. And often the calling will call, hello, 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 and you don't listen. And then all of a sudden, in the right configuration, with the right spirit, with the right independence at the right time, these packages come together in very, very unique pieces. Now, you said that you were raised in, were you raised as a Baptist in North Carolina, or was it some other?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, yes. I was actually raised Southern Baptist, like I said, down in Charlotte. Very, very conservative Southern Baptist church down there, which, you know, Steve, honestly, I mean, I'm a minister. I'm not supposed to diss people. So let's just say that you can always count on the theology of the Southern Baptist to be short and sweet, like their idea of heaven. You know, you ain't Southern Baptist. You ain't coming.
Yeah,
this whole thing, you know, it's just I share this with your listeners because this is sort of the hummus from which I was birthed. And it was, you know, it was a world that it was not one that really worked for my sense of the world. So long story short, I ended up having to jump ship and I went to what's called American Baptist. They are a much more moderate denomination. Of course, we have left and right on the extremes there too, but it's in the Civil War, the Baptists split between Southern Baptist and Northern Baptist over the issue of slavery. And Northern Baptist became American Baptist, which is the church I'm part of now. And, you know, the Baptist in general, people don't really get that nuance, and there's no reason they should. You know, who's going to read Baptist history for, you know, fun? But my goal is to, I guess at this point, really reframe the face of the church, and especially the Baptist face of the church. And I want to reframe it from a face of judgment and shame to one of joy and hope. Because as you said in the beginning, that's really the essence of what is going to heal this country, this world, you know, and us as human beings. And so this is my little corner of it, and I'm trying to do the best I can to change it.
You know, one of the things that my wife Trudy and I have adopted over this past year, a friend of ours gave us an entire collection of Touched by an Angel videos from the 90s. And we started watching these, and that is the exact message. It's that God loves you. God loves you. God loves you. Yes. And anytime they can go to a point of judgment or a point of separation, they take the step to focus on the love part. I have a good friend who grew up in Texas, and I said, well, what was your religion? He said, oh, we were devil worshipers. Devil worshipers? He says, yeah, we went to a Baptist church and all the minister ever talked about was a devil. So I figured we must be devil worshipers, you know?
Well, I love that. And, you know, I resonate with what you say, Steve, about, you know, God loves you. It's what I find in my little family here at Madison Avenue Baptist is that I get an awful lot of folks who have ricocheted out of the church because of judgment and harm. Some people have literally been kicked out of the church because of who they love or, you know, how they engage the world. And so I find people walking in the door because they yearn for a sense of comfort and hope. They want to reconnect to what they were brought up with a sense of kind of a larger, greater power, but they've been so harmed in the past that they're scared to come in. And that makes me so sad because the power of the words, you know, which whatever world religious tradition you're talking about or even a larger universal ethic, you have to have that grounding. And you have to have that sense of worth in this world to get through.
You know, one of the missing pieces that I've found is that the reason, to me, this is only my reasoning, that the power of money has become so important, the power of money, the power of materialism, is that there's a vacuum at the center. There is a missing sense of sacred that, as you pointed out, is bigger than any particular religion. They may be different words, or they may be just silence, but it's that sense of a bigger love, of something bigger than us, of a bigger purpose. And because we can't quite agree on what that is, it's kind of fallen apart, fallen away.
Yeah, totally. And what you just said reminds me, we have we put these marquees out in front of the church, funny, catchy signs that people can take photos of and, you know, share. One, my favorite one last year was honk if you love Jesus, text while driving if you want to meet him, which I thought was great. This is great. You know, I think another one was what happens in Vegas is forgiven here. But one that reminds me of what you just said was one that about a month ago that said, some people are so poor, all they have is money. And I think that's so true. You know, so true.
So this is really interesting. We're going to talk more about what it's like to be on Madison Avenue. You know, I spent my deformative years in New York, and I'm sure it's changed a lot since then. You know, but there's certain things that you can relate to that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
As a New Yorker by coming there. But anyway, we're going to take a very short break, and we'll be back. We'll talk more about some of your work with other religious leaders and doing comedy. So we'll be back with Reverend Susan Sparks after these short messages.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America. 200 food banks strong.
Okay, we're back with Susan Sparks. Given the political polarization that we started talking about, and humor often being used as a weapon, I'm curious as to how you've used humor to bring people together. Particularly, I was very curious about your little comedy tour with the rabbi and the Muslim comedians. Tell us about that.
Well, I think it really comes down to finding common ground, Steve. That's what we need so desperately now. And we're so entrenched in our positions that we don't see it. And back in 2001, right after 9/11, Rabbi Bob Alper, who was at that point in time, he had left his congregation. He'd been a rabbi for about 20 years and had become a full-time comedian. He put together the Laugh and Peace Tour, which has now been going strong for almost 20 years. And so I was in seminary at the time, and I joined him. And then we joined with a Muslim comedian named Ahmed Ahmed, who now is primarily movies in Hollywood, so we've moved on to several other comedians. But we've been going strong, like I said, for about 20 years. We got globally broadcast by the World Bank, with the Clinton Center, the Clinton Presidential Center put us up for a big night there. We had congregations, whether it is a church or a synagogue or a mosque. There was a big festival, the Muslim Fest in Toronto. I mean, we've been everywhere, and it's just the most, I think, I mean, I love my church, but it's got to be, I'd say it's the most healing thing that I'm blessed to do in my work. I'm the MC. I get up in the beginning. I'm sort of the Christian chick MC, and I get up in front of an audience that is everything from, you know, burkas and Easter hats to yarmulkes, and everybody's sort of looking at each other like, what is this all about? And if I do my job right, then within, you know, 10 or 15 seconds, the entire crowd is laughing, which means that they're sharing something in common. Because you can't laugh at a joke unless you share the premise of the joke. And that's our whole point, is that you can't hate somebody that you laugh with. When you laugh with somebody, your worlds overlap for a split second, and all of a sudden you share something, which means the commonalities gleam through. Yeah, and I know some of your listeners may be going, yeah, well, how does this work, though? I mean, what do y'all do? And each of us gets up and does an independent little set of our own. So we tell our own stories, you know, like about our families and growing up. It's not really religious at all. It's just about our crazy lives. And but in those stories, the commonalities of us as human beings come out. For example, Bob talks about learning Hebrew in seminary as a rabbi. Or a baby rabbi, and then he went to Jerusalem to try it out. You know, I was so excited. So he gets in a cab and he tells the cab driver, "Let me off here," and the guy just burst out laughing, and he says, "Do you have any idea what you said?" Bob said, "Well, I said let me out here," and he goes, "No, what you said is, 'Behold, here I descend.'" And you know, you don't have to be Jewish or a rabbi or seminary or anything to understand that. It's just a basic issue of translation. You know, I mean, Assar talks about a Muslim going through the airport, which, you know, we can all just can't even get our minds around that. And he says, you know, "I don't understand why you guys get so upset having to be there 2 hours ahead of time. I have to be there 2 months ahead of time." Yeah. You know, and again, we all kind of like roll our eyes with the TSA and the thing. And Bob usually ends the show with this little story. And again, I think if anyone else told this, if I told it, it may or may not be the right thing to do. But as a rabbi, he tells the story to show what we have in common, especially when we are doing shows in a church. So he says, "I'll leave you with this story. Two rabbis were talking, and one says to the other, I don't know how to tell you this, but my son converted to Christianity." And the other rabbi said, "Really? My son too. What should we do?" And the two rabbis thought for a minute. They said, "Let's go talk to God." So they go talk to God. And one of the rabbis says, "Both of our sons has converted to Christianity. What should we do?" And God says, "Really? My son too." You know, and again, you know, coming from a rabbi sharing that in kind of love and joy of just saying, hey, hello, you know, we all kind of have a thread of commonality here. So it's a lovely blessing to be able to work with these guys. I just adore them. They're friends of mine outside of work, but we need more of that. And we just, I think people are immune to it. They can't hear it now because of the horrible negativity that is coming out of the press and out of every single aspect of the world that we engage with. So I'm hopeful that our little stories every once in a while, our shows will bring people together and give them a little something to think about. If nothing else, it gives them a different face of each religion, different than what people see on TV or read about or hear about, even out of some of the very, you know, judgmental pulpits of some of our houses of religion.
You know, what you're talking about is rehumanization, and what happens in a digital world where we're already we're intentionally provoked, let's say, by polarizing points of view that play to anger and fear, separation, et cetera, and what this is, what you're talking about, is rehumanizing the other. And this is, I was part of something called the Jewish-Palestinian Reconciliation Group in the Bay Area about 10 years ago, and I was invited to do comedy for a holiday gathering, you know, and they had, one of the great ways to bring people together is around food, because they had all of this wonderful Middle Eastern food, and we just loved food. And it was pretty much half of what Palestinians and half were Jewish people. And I was a little uncomfortable because they asked me to do channel George Gershwin's song for peace in the Middle East, which is, you say salam and I say shalom, you throw a bomb, I blow up your home, salam, shalom, we blow up our home, let's call the whole thing off, right? Okay, but I went, okay, they want me to do it, and I did the whole song. Well, afterward, we sat in a circle and people shared, and I was shocked at how much people loved that and how relieved they were to be able to tell the truth through the eyes of humor. And I think that that's really what you're doing. You're actually focusing on the higher truth of what we all have in common. And then you're essentially pointing out the human foibles without accusing anybody of anything. It's a wonderful healing piece that you're doing. I appreciate that you're doing that.
Well, can I throw one other thing in about that?
Yeah, please.
It dawned on me as you were talking. Two things. One is, I love the idea of the food. I had been doing some reading and a little research on something now called gastrodiplomacy, which I find fascinating. For example, George Washington University's got a program on it in their international studies section, and they're trying to find bases for bringing people together and finding commonalities. And you know, to sit around the table at the UN and try to find political common ground ain't so easy. But when you bring in, you know, some baklava and a casserole, then bam, there's like, oh, we all eat. And oh, you make this and then you grew up making that. And all of a sudden, the conversation breaks completely open. So I love that idea. I think food and humor are got to be the two most powerful tools that can break open and bring sort of a fresh new, not only a new perspective, but a little bit of trust, obviously rapport, but more importantly, trust among peoples that they could actually share their thoughts and their feelings and what they've been carrying.
Yeah, I was also curious. I love something that you said on your website. I help people reclaim their joy. So as a minister, as a comedian, say more about reclaiming our joy.
Steve, I feel strongly, and maybe it's just out of my own personal experience, but that the world will do its best to try to beat the joy out of us. I know everybody, but isn't that the truth? In a Baptist church, I would say, can I have an amen? Can I have an amen? Because we've all been there, you know. I'm a cancer survivor. I, lost both parents, blah, blah, blah. We've all had our stuff. And there's it's part of it is life circumstances. Part of it is the negative people around us. Can I have an amen? And part of it is the negative rhetoric that surrounds us. Whatever it is, the world will try to beat it out of us. And my job on this earth, I have become very clear, is to help people remember that it's still there, and to help them reclaim that joy. That even in the worst of circumstances, it's still life. I think the person I learned that from was my dad, Herb. Don't you love that name? And I might have even told the story back when I first met you, because it's just stayed with me ever since then. I've shared it with so many people, and it just resonates, I think, with everybody. It's the bottom line is I was with him one of the last days before he passed. He was very, very sick. At that time, he was 89 years old and going through some very difficult, painful medical issues. And he had been in and out of consciousness, and a nurse walks in, and I don't know, she's about 7 years old, maybe, and I looked kind of like Britney Spears. And Dad, miracle, his eyes, when she says Mr. Sparks, he starts sitting up, fixing his pajamas. I'm like, hello, family, been here all day. You could have talked to me, whatever. And Brittany waltzes in and says, Mr. Sparks, I'm sorry to bother you. I'm just here to check your catheter. Okay, I'm the daughter. I'm so uncomfortable. I'm like bolting out of the room. As I'm walking out, I hear my dad take this deep, deep breath and in a thick Southern accent say, well, honey, you just make yourself to home. Okay. You know, oh. So, you know, for years after that, I was like, oh, my God, that's just so embarrassing. I can't believe you did that, Dad. But honestly, Steve, as we all do, we unpack this stuff over time. And I started to see the wisdom in it, which is this. And it's so simple but so powerful. In any difficult situation, it doesn't matter where you are or what's going on. In any difficult situation, we have two choices. We could stay in a place of pain and negativity and bring everybody else down with us. Or we can find something to be grateful for, something to smile about, something to laugh about, something to embarrass your daughter about in front of the nurse. And then what happens, it lifts your heart and everyone else around you with it. It's that simple. And so that little simple lesson, embarrassing as it was, I think really got me framed around the purpose and focus of what I want to do, which is remind people that their joy is still there and that they can reclaim it.
Yeah, and it's such a simple thing, and there's so much to, you know, there's so many things to thwart it. You know, we were talking about they beat it out of you. Years ago, I wrote a country song about, everybody says I should try to be Jesus, something about being Jesus, and I could be Jesus too, but every time I try to be Jesus, why do they beat the bejesus out of you? You know, so.
Oh, God. Oh, well, that's a much better country song. That's the ones I'm thinking of are like, if I'd shot you when I wanted, I'd be out by now. You know, I mean. I like this better.
Well, you know, it's kind of a lament, because I think that, you know, we human beings have been damaged by thousands of years of living by the lowest, under the rule of the lowest common denominator. And if you look at the message that Jesus's message that shines through in all of this, and the message really at the root of every ethical and religious tradition, is that we're really all in this together. And you know, if what you do to the least of us, you do to me. Love thy neighbor, the golden rule, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think when you allow people to reclaim their joy, that opens up a lot of space for them to bring other people in rather than reject other people. It breaks down the walls rather than builds the walls. And we're at a time when
absolutely
fear builds walls. So something
absolutely
else.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, because I have another question related to this, but continue. We have something more to say.
Well, I was just going to say, it's also, I mean, especially from a religious standpoint, from my kind of my tradition, it's our inheritance. You know, that's how my argument from the pulpit all the time. We are, you know, Genesis says we were made in the image of the divine, and human beings laugh. So it doesn't take a trial lawyer or a huge logic jump to realize that means part of the holy is joy and laughter. There's a component of the creator, the universe, that's joy and laughter. So it is part of our legacy. It's part of our inheritance. And we have just checked it at the door like we check our coats. And the only way to be whole is bring it all, the anger, the tears, the joy, and the laughter, because that's the only way we get healed.
You know, it's funny. I just reminded that the last fall I got to do a Sunday morning talk about humor at a kind of a conservative Presbyterian church in Nebraska. And it was all, you know, the choir is wearing these beautiful blue robes. It was very formal. And at some point very early in the service, I turned to where the choir was and I said, how many of you believe that laughter is healing? And they all raised their hand, and I go, huh, I'm preaching to the choir here. And
oh, please.
When do you ever get a chance to say that, right? You know, so
I'm stealing that too.
You should steal that too.
I will steal all that too, for sure.
Something else related to reclaiming the joy, which is in a way the flip side, but very related, is that you also connect laughter and forgiveness. So why is forgiveness important, and how does it relate to laughter?
Well, I have always said, this is my little kind of one line or kind of two phrase, one line summary of what I believe. And that is, if you can laugh at yourself, you can forgive yourself. And if you can forgive yourself, you can forgive others. End of story. That's kind of the whole ethic in a nutshell right there. And I think we're especially – you know, we always think about forgiveness in terms of others, but the bottom line is we may be where it's hard on others. It's hard, if not harder, on ourselves than we are other people. And I think that's part of where the source of judgment comes from, is that we have a lot of self-doubt, a lot of self-loathing, which makes us lash out at others. So, you know, Charlie Chaplin said, life in the close-up is a tragedy. Life in the long shot is a comedy. And mm-hmm. that's what laughter helps us do, step back, get perspective. And when we have a little perspective, we realize that we're just human beings, you know, we're just doing the best we can. And maybe we might find a bit of forgiveness for ourselves, as well as then as a natural response as to find forgiveness for others. I mean, I'll just share this one little quick story. I sort of along the idea that we need to kind of cut ourselves a break and that we try to be perfect all the time. There's no such thing as perfection, and things aren't always as they seem. We think we know what's going on and we think we have a grasp on, you know, truth. My husband Toby and I were taking a train trip two Thanksgivings ago on Amtrak. We decided to do cross country, and lovely, except for their tiny little rooms. And by the time you get to California, you're a little tired. And anyway, the day we're going into San Diego, he goes, gets coffee, and I think, I'm going to fix up. Southern lady, I'm going to put on some makeup, look a little nice. You know, he comes back and he goes, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, you look so angry. And then I learned an important lesson, which is never draw your eyebrows on a moving train. Okay, so don't do that. Never. And I share that story partly because it's true and it's sort of funny, but also the idea that, you know, we got to cut ourselves a break. We think, you know, there's so many levels of that story. It's like, you know, there's can't be perfect. And we also, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover. You got to just back off, get some perspective, give yourself a little bit of a break and find some forgiveness.
I love that. Never do your eyebrows on a moving train. I mean, I think maybe Confucius. I think Confucius first said that many years ago.
Yes, Aristotle.
We're going to take Aristotle even before that. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll be back with Susan Sparks to talk a little more about how to use humor in divisive times. This is Steve Behrman. We're on Wiki Politiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wound, sir?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency? 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, hi, Steve Behrman back with our guest, Susan Sparks. She's a minister. She's a comedian. And boy, we could spend several hours on this one. But let's, for this last segment, let's really talk about how in your diverse community, and I'm sure it is on Madison Avenue in New York City, how have you been able to bridge the political divide? I'm sure that there's still a political divide in the community and congregation. And what can the rest of us learn about that?
Steve, you asked some great questions, I'll tell you right now. I don't know. I mean, I don't have any kind of perfect answer to that. I can just share what we've been doing. And, you know, the bottom line is I look out from the pulpit, or when we weren't, we're all virtual now, but I used to look out from the pulpit, and we would, and I would see Russians sitting next to Ukraine with, you know, Asian, African-American, Hispanic, 97 years old down to 2 years old. So we're doing something right. There's a really lovely little diverse family, but, it's just so disheartening, especially in our own country. It's like, I don't know, it's like the San Andreas Fault has just jumped out and embedded itself in the heart of every citizen. It's like we just have this fault line down our heart. And I saw this great greeting card recently, and it was like these two little 1950s ladies, you know, with their little kind of hat and gloves, and actually no gloves, just hat. And they both had cigarettes, and one took a big puff of her cigarettes, like, and she's saying to the other one, "All I know is that one of us is right and the other is you." And I thought, oh my gosh, that's our country down to the ground, like right there on that greeting card. And I bought like 100 of them and sent them to everybody. But the ironic thing is that it's what we're feeling and what we're being taught to think. But the truth of the matter is that we have so much more in common than we know or think. And that's part of what we do, or I'm trying to do, is remind us of that commonality. Some of your listeners may have read about a study that scientists have done pretty recently that on the genetic front, that has shown that all human beings, notwithstanding ethnicity, nationality, gender, anything, are 99.99% genetically the same, which means that all of the anger and fighting and divides and violence and war are over 0.01%. Hello? It's like mind-boggling. It's just like we can't get past that 0.01%. I love Jack Kornfield. He's this wonderful writer and a speaker, and he tells a story about two POWs. One says to the other, "Have you forgiven your captors yet?" And the second one thinks for a minute and says, "No, never." And the first one says, "Well, I guess they still have you in prison, don't they?" Mm-hmm. And it's like, and you just hear that story and you think, yep, there it is. And we don't even see it anymore, but we're all imprisoned by that 0.01% difference. We can't let go of that. And if nothing else, if we can simply break through to reality as opposed to the rhetoric, to what is the truth of our genetic commonality, our shared experience commonality, our cultural commonality, you know, sitting down and having the casserole and the baklava and laughing together like you guys did in your story, which was so wonderful, then that to me is just the best first step that we can take. I hate to say it. Our generation, we can do the best we can, but I think where we're really going to see this take root is in the future generations. I think it's going to take a couple of generations for this to recover. I really do. It's like a forest fire. It's like the tragic California fires. It wipes it out, but new growth comes back. And then in a couple of generations, the forest is back. So, you know, I don't want to be glib and say, oh, this will solve everything, but I have a great hope that it will, in the long term, make a huge difference.
Well, I think right now, I mean, certainly we've had not just a generation gap, but a degeneration gap, because it's been essentially a degeneration. But I think that, you know, my colleague Bruce Lipton, cellular biologist, says that crisis precipitates evolution. And the next phase of human evolution is recognizing that we're all cells in the same superorganism called humanity, and that much of what much of our activities are really wasteful, dangerous, toxic autoimmune dysfunction, where healthy human cells are fighting other healthy human cells. And there is a study done very recently where at least 70% of the people, this is right in the midst of all the polarity, at least 70% of us would love to find a way to get along, would love to find a way to begin to collaborate. And because the institutions of society are generally not helping, these new institutions and little oases like what you have. And I'm sure that the spiritual center I visited in the Presbyterian Church in Omaha, same thing. They were focused on love. They were focused on bringing people together. But that's not what makes the news. And so we have to make our own news in this regard. And, you know, it sounds like, you know, so much of the good work that's going on is unsung. So we need to sing it. We need to sing it.
That's so true. I shouldn't say the other side, because that just plays into the whole kind of divide. But I'm tired of the negative voices having the mic. We got to take the mic back.
Exactly. This is the new mic. Now, as we approach the end here, I want to ask you, you know, we met about 20 years ago when you were, I think, 3 years old, you know, so now that you're 23 and you've been on this comedy ministry journey, what's been the most important thing that you've learned? You know, what jumps out at you as, oh, my God, had I not taken this path, I wouldn't know this.
Oh, once again, a great question, Steve. Thank you. I guess as a 20-year pastor and stand-up, which, again, even like the law, is sort of the same role, pastors and comedians, because when we do our job right, we stand in solidarity with people. That's mm-hmm. really what it comes down to. So as a 20-year preaching pastor and a comedian, what I've learned through observation and engagement is that people across the globe are hungry for comfort, for hope, and for joy. They're hungry for it. And they're hungry now more than ever, but have always just consistently been, as long as I've been on this earth, hungry for it. And whatever we can do to generate that, not only for ourselves, but to share it with others, is our highest and best calling. You hear that and you go, oh my gosh, so I got to change the world or I'm not successful. No, that's not what I'm saying. I think it's really simple. And it's just something even as simple as a smile. You know, Stephen, I'm sure you've read this too. There's studies and so much writing about the fact that just the act of making a smile with the muscles in the face triggers neurons in the brain that tap chemicals like endorphins, et cetera, that raise our mood, which in short means fake it till you make it really works. So literally changing our facial expression changes within ourselves. The feeling brings on, invites joy. And then the next step, perhaps more importantly, is when we smile at others, we change them as well. You know, studies show that humans tend to mimic facial expression. And perhaps Louis Armstrong put it better than any scientist, which is smile and the world smiles with you. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't swing people's opinion, then, you know, not that corporate America knows everything, but it is interesting that they've glommed onto this. And there's something called the 10-5 rule that people like Disney and Ritz-Carlton and all the different hospitality industries have started, which means their employees, when they are 10 feet from any guest, are asked to smile at the guest because they know that smile will in fact change the guest's experience. And when they're 5 feet from the guest, they are to actually engage. How are you? Hello. And just the simple act of a smile and how we interface with people organically, you know, physiologically, experientially changes that experience in there and changes the room we're in, therefore changes these people go out, they experience other people, change, a chain reaction. So it's not that hard. And I really believe that we truly can change the world if we change our own hearts, which is the only thing that's going to bring that comfort, hope, and joy that people yearn for, that the world yearns for.
Well, it definitely starts at home. It starts where you are. And you're absolutely right. You change the body chemistry by smiling, and then you change other people when they're looking at the smile. And I know that, of course, we're all challenged right now with this mask thing. You actually had some really interesting way to show smiles. Was that you? You talked about smiling with your eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote a whole sermon and I do a syndicated column for some newspapers, and it was called smizing. But it's not my term. It's if anybody listening has watched America's Next Top Model, one of the long-running reality shows with Tyra Banks. Anyway, she talks about smizing, and it's apparently a term in modeling, which is your face can be completely flat and devoid of emotion, but you can smile with your eyes. You can see it. So especially with close-up headshots, things of that nature. So we found this out. Toby and I, again, were walking to the grocery store with our masks on, and you know, everybody's looking all kind of down and bummed out and even angry until yet one woman we pass looks up and smiles, and yet she had a mask on. And I turned to Toby because I said, did you see that woman? She smiled at us. And he goes, how did you know she had a mask? And I said, well, and then it dawned on me, what a powerful statement. So it's not that hard. And even in the times of COVID, we can bring that joy. We can share that kind of intimacy, that rapport, that honesty with a simple facial gesture.
You know, in fact, when this thing first started, I just made it a point when I go to the bank or at a place. And usually it was a woman, a young woman, generally, because it was easy to do that. And I'd say, wow, what a great smile you have. And of course, she would start laughing, you know, because I'm looking at her through the mask. Obviously, you can't see a smile. But what it did was when you tell people what a great smile they have and they have a mask on, that makes them smile. And then you could see it in their eyes. So I think that's probably the best we can do right now. You know, in addition, I've been a comedian for longer than you have, but I've never been the head of a spiritual community. So you actually have this other role. In addition to knowing the power of humor and knowing the power of bringing people together that way, you're also, as a designated head of a spiritual community. Not the same as being a trial attorney, not the same as being a stand-up comic. What's that been like, and what are the challenges of that particular aspect of the calling?
Well, it's changed over the years, Steve, which, as you can imagine, I have been with this church for 20 years, which is kind of hard to even articulate that. It's hard to believe I've been there 20 years. I started as a student and stayed as the assistant, the associate, and then took over as the senior pastor in 2007. And with the city and the church, things have changed over time. We have grown. Our demographics have changed. Our neighborhoods changed. You know, I've taken this church through 9/11. Through, the stock market crash, through COVID, through, you just name it. But our church is also 174 years old this year. And you sit down and you look at the wall of faces, and this church has gone through the Civil War, the Great World Wars, the 1917 pandemic. I mean, anyway, long story short, I mean, I think we see some continuity and sense of family with that. And I guess as the leader of a spiritual community, you start to see the power of that sense of family, that power of community, of the need of connection. And especially now during the pandemic, when we don't meet on site, how do you create that family and that community virtually, which we, we're doing it through services, we're doing it through Zoom, God bless them, and however else we can make it work. But I don't know that it was until the pandemic that I fully appreciated the power of the presence of other human beings coming together for one common cause. It was in the pandemic when we couldn't have it that I started realizing, I mean, I knew it was important, but now I realize it's everything. So
yeah.
I think that was a very big important realization for me as a leader of a community. And we will go back on site, but here's our challenge and what we're excited about trying to do. We are virtual right now, as most religious services are, but we're trying to go fully digital so that instead of being a physical presence, a church with a digital imprint, a little website, we're flipping it. And we're going to become fully digital with a physical imprint so that everything that's available on, on site, whether it's a baby blessing or joining the church or getting baptized or, doing a letter writing together for some homebound members, all of that is going to be fully available online. And we happen to have a space that you can come meet together and be present. And I guess the reason I'm mentioning this is because I do believe that this pandemic has pushed us to figure out how to tap that power of community without physical presence. It's possible, yeah. And it can be done. And I don't think before we realized it, A, the power of that community, and B, how do you replicate it outside of all sitting together in a pew? So there is a blessing in the midst of the pain, and that's what I've learned. That's where we are with my particular community of faith, and it's something I'm excited about us exploring.
Of course, because of the kind of sermons that you give, I mean, that's something that can outreach quite a bit. But I think that what you're talking about is ways of reaching people. My whole gig has been traveling and doing shows until last February, where I'm mm-hmm. home, but I am doing Zoom shows. And the joke is mm-hmm. you can actually, Zoom is the only place that you can see people without masks, you know? And you don't have to wear a mask on Zoom. In fact, you don't even have to wear pants, actually. But who knows? Who's going to know? But I think that's really, the proper use of electronic media is to open the heart. And I think that's perhaps in this challenge, we've found that. Well, I was so happy to have this conversation with you, Reverend Susan Sparks. We'll be talking
Thank
with you,
you
again.
Steve.
Yes, it was a pleasure. And this is Steve Bamman on Wiki Politiki. Thank you so much, Susan, for giving us some laughter and some wisdom and some insight. We'll be back again next week on Wiki Politiki. This is Steve Bamman.